There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
So Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. Turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about President Trump's legal issues. And Ken White is with me. Ken is my co-host, a criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor. And he blogs at popehat.com. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
It's been an eventful week. Of course, the impeachment trial of President Trump has been ongoing, but the biggest trial developments have arguably occurred outside the Senate chamber. The New York Times has reported on the contents of John Bolton's forthcoming tell-all book. Bolton, of course, is the former national security advisor. Among other claims, the book says that the president told Bolton he wanted military aid to Ukraine withheld until Ukraine would probe Joe and Hunter Biden. That contradicts the president's claims that he withheld the aid for other reasons, to do with his general suspicion of foreign aid and his broad concerns about corruption in Ukraine. But the Senate may not hear about this from Bolton. As we tape, senators are asking questions of the House managers and of the president's lawyers. They'll be done with that on Thursday, and then the Senate will vote on whether to call any witnesses at all. News reports on Thursday had senators on both sides of the aisle increasingly confident the Republican majority would hold together and reject the proposition of additional witnesses, including Bolton. Ken, let's start with what we are hearing in the trial. Obviously, one of the key questions that they are getting at here is whether any quid pro quo regarding Ukraine was a corrupt quid pro quo. When can the president ask a foreign country to do something? Did the president do so in a way that was so improper that he deserves to be removed from office? And I gather that Alan Dershowitz, who's one of the attorneys representing the president, said basically the president can ask for anything that he sees as enhancing his chances of reelection. And so long as the president believes that it would be in the national interest for him to be reelected, that's okay. It's not a misuse of government resources to make that ask.
I wish I could say that was an exaggeration, but if anything, it's underplaying what he said. This was the modern equivalent of President Nixon's famous, if the president does it, it's not illegal. In the context of talking about whether or not President Trump could, for the reason that he wanted to aid his own reelection, ask for this quid pro quo, Professor Dershowitz said very clearly that if he thinks his reelection is best for the country, then that is not impeachable, even if he asks for a quid pro quo. The president's defenders have shifted noticeably from attacking the concept that there was a quid pro quo, which seems like a truly lost cause, over to suggesting that it doesn't matter if it was a quid pro quo, or a related argument, somewhat softer, the argument that if the president had mixed motives, if partly he was interested in investigating corruption, but also interested in his electoral chances, that that's acceptable and not impeachable.
So basically, I mean, you talk about two possible defenses there. The president didn't do this, or so what if he did do it? And they're moving toward the so what defense. I feel like there's a third unspoken defense, mostly unspoken. We haven't been hearing it in the Senate, but we got it actually from Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in his blow up with NPR reporter Mary Louise Kelly, where she asked him some questions about Ukraine and Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch that he didn't like. And one of the things that Pompeo said to Kelly off recording is, do you think Americans care about Ukraine? And so, I mean, I guess the third possibility here for why you wouldn't remove the president is not that he didn't do this and not that he was allowed to do it, but so what if he did it? Who cares? It may be against the rules, but because Ukraine is unimportant to America's interests and concerns, why would we care if the president acted in an improper manner with regard to Ukraine?
Well, that seems to be the subtext of the arguments that we ought to let the voters decide, that we shouldn't impeach someone for misconduct when there's an election coming up so soon. But it seems to me, Josh, that pitching it as about how important Ukraine is has it completely wrong. The issue isn't just that the president was extorting and abusing Ukraine. The issue is that he was attempting to use a foreign power to harass and disadvantage a political opponent here in the United States, that he was, in effect, impeding a fair election here by using his power over another country. So doesn't, you know, whether he did that with Ukraine or Liechtenstein or whatever, it doesn't come into it. It's the impact here, I think, that's important.
Is that precisely the charge, though? I mean, when we say that the president abused his power, isn't that he was taking something of value, which is to say, the foreign policy of the United States, and using it toward his own personal purposes? So if you're going to go for the who cares defense, it seems like a key question there is, how valuable was this thing really, the foreign policy of the United States? If it was incidental to the concerns of Americans, what he did with the foreign policy with regard to Ukraine, then, you know, maybe it's, you know, maybe it's like stealing the coat hangers from your hotel room. You know, it's illegal. You're not supposed to do it, but who cares?
Well, but it's not only just the using the power, it's the end for which he's using the power. It's the what is the personal benefit. And I think here the argument is that the personal benefit is fundamentally corrupt, that he's using the power through this cutout of Ukraine to attack someone he's running against. So that undermines legitimacy of our elections. It's not explicitly spelled out that way in the impeachment count, but that's been the House manager's presentation through a lot of this. The notion that there's a terrible specter of the executive being able to sick foreign powers on their opponents, using the might of the United States to make them do it.
So when we think about the president's culpability here as hinging on his motivation, did he think that he was doing this for a genuine national interest purpose, or was he doing this for a personal purpose? That seems like where John Bolton's testimony would be likely to be really relevant. I mean, Bolton says that that he was told something by the president about why he was withholding the aid that is contrary to the defense that has been made of him. So it seems like, you know, one thing we talked about last week was how what we've been hearing over the last few days were opening statements in this trial, but they're really of a different nature than the opening statements that you would have in a criminal trial, much longer with much more content to them, content that is based upon witness testimony that was delivered in the House. So I guess my question is, you know, is this trial really incomplete without John Bolton's testimony, and are there any other witnesses without whom this trial is incomplete as the senators look back on what they have heard over the last week and a half?
Well, you're right that it's completely unlike a normal opening statement. It more resembles a closing statement in a trial where you get to marshal all the evidence that's come before and argue to the decider of fact how they should come out. But that question of whether or not any witnesses are essential is definitely the Senate's to decide. And I think every indication is that they're going to decide it's not by the typical 53-47 vote. And I think that the way that they are going to spin it is that these witnesses don't matter because even in, you know, the scenario most deferring to the House manager's argument, it doesn't matter because he had mixed motives and that's okay, or because a quid pro quo is not impeachable, or whatever it's going to be. I certainly think that if you cared about what the truth was here, if you cared about what the president did, you would want to hear from Bolton and several other people at least.
But this does have a parallel to some questions that you would have in a regular criminal trial, right? Where, like, you know, the question is, do you have a dispute of facts or do you have a dispute over the law? And so if, you know, if the question is, you know, here are some things the president could have done that would be removable, here are some other things that would not have been removable, we need to know exactly what he did, what his motivations were for it. But if you buy the Dershowitz argument or something closely related to it, then maybe John Bolton's testimony doesn't matter, right? Because it doesn't, you know, the additional information about the president's motivations is not material to the question of whether you would remove him or not.
Well, sure. If you buy Dershowitz's argument, then the entire House manager presentation is completely irrelevant because his rather startlingly broad pronouncement is that if the president thinks that his reelection is in the nation's interest, then no quid pro quo that he might put together is impeachable. So it does become irrelevant. It does become suitable for a motion to dismiss. But I would be surprised if many of the senators were really comfortable openly embracing a position that extreme. And it would be hard to imagine many of them liking that shoe being on the other foot with a president of the other party exercising such broad and frankly illegal powers. I think that the Republicans have boxed themselves into a position of articulating an almost unlimited presidential power, almost imperial. Greg Lukianoff of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education had an excellent point that if you put together all of the GOP's positions and the president's positions, they seem to be that only an actual crime is impeachable, but the president cannot be investigated for a crime by anybody, federal or state. And if Congress wants to investigate him for the crime, then he can refuse to cooperate and stop any branch of the government from cooperating, and there's nothing you can do about it. That's a rather shocking series of propositions that seems to make the president really not a limited government figure, but an absolute power.
And I think institutionalizes the argument that you've been hearing in the specific situation from Republicans, which, you know, the president would remain accountable only to the electorate in that situation. And you could say, well, you know, the president, if voters don't like what the president's been up to, they can remove him. But then the question would be why there is an impeachment clause at all in the Constitution. I want to ask you about something that you said a few weeks ago. We were talking about John Bolton, who had resisted efforts to bring him before House committees to testify. He was never actually subpoenaed, but he was making clear that he was going to tie that up in court if he was subpoenaed. He was signaling a few weeks ago that he would be willing to talk in a Senate trial if he were asked. And you thought at the time that he was not being genuine, that he did not want to testify, that he was trying to signal a willingness in a circumstance where he was confident the Senate would not actually call him. Do you still believe that Bolton was being insincere when he was signaling a willingness to testify?
Well, what complicates that view a little bit now is this revelation that he has this book warmed up, that it's been being vetted by the White House under its pre-publication review for classified information. So maybe his view was always that he would testify in the Senate because it would be a chance to promote his book. I don't think he was ever going to be cooperative for cooperation's own sake. That doesn't seem to be him. But now that his book has become a big issue, he certainly and his lawyers certainly seem to be using the historic moment to promote it and him.
So, I mean, one question that I've had and a lot of people have had is if John Bolton has burning information that he's dying to get out here, why can't he just put it out there? Why can't he just make statements? He could sit for a media interview. They could rush the book out for publication. You know, presumably this has been great promotion. If his goal is to sell books, then, you know, why not have the book out tomorrow? And so I guess, is it possible that the reason that he has not availed himself of other avenues to share this information, that he's been trying to get himself called to testify, is it possible that it has to do with legal restrictions around what he can say and where? Which is to say, you mentioned the book had to be reviewed by the White House for classified information. I gather there are also some executive privilege concerns here. Is it basically that if he's called to testify, then he can spill the beans, he doesn't face those legal restrictions? The other avenues, such as rushing the book out or doing a media interview, he might run into legal roadblocks if he tried to use those.
So it's clear that there are restrictions on his ability and his publisher's ability to put the book out now. Like most people working in anything connected to the intelligence community, he had to sign certain non-disclosure agreements that force him, before he publishes something like a book, to run it past the intelligence community and make sure there's nothing classified in it. And this is a process that's actually quite controversial, that the ACLU and other rights organizations have been fighting against, because the way it plays out is that if the government makes, you know, bad faith, disingenuous claims that your work has classified information in it, then it's left to you to go to court to challenge that, unless you want to risk being sued by the government or even prosecuted. And the government has in the past sued people who have just gone ahead and published the books, and sometimes been successful in getting all the proceeds of the book. So I think he and his lawyers and his publishers are justifiably concerned about just rushing the book out. That said, there are not the same array of procedures and restrictions on him testifying or otherwise making verbal statements out there, particularly if he's being compelled to do so. So yeah, he certainly could testify, and there wouldn't be the same set of consequences for that.
And what if he just gave a news media interview?
That's a good question. So the rules and the Supreme Court cases about pre-publication review really talk more about written publications and books and things like that. It's not as clear as how it would apply to like a live interview. And I think it would be considerably harder For the administration to make a case that, you know, a particular verbal statement revealed classified information. In other words, it's harder for them to BS their way through than it is through a lengthy book with tons of text and footnotes and that sort of thing. If you're just there giving a few sentences, they really are forced to articulate why exactly this is classified. And a lot of the things he is talking about clearly are not classified.
Yeah, you mentioned the possibility that the White House could make bad faith objections about classification. And in fact, the White House has sent a letter to Bolton's publisher saying that there are substantial amounts of top secret information in this book, which you need to remove before publication. His attorney has put a response back basically saying, we don't think any of this could be reasonably considered to be classified. So he would have to go to court to get this resolved if the White House is trying to kill the publication. And conceivably, that could take some time, right?
Well, he would have to go to court or risk the consequences. So it's either go to court and go through the litigation process to get a judge to rule that you can publish. And yes, that could take years, potentially. Or you publish and you take your chances. And those chances include, you know, a lawsuit by the government seeking to seize all the proceeds of your book.
And then what about executive privilege issues? I mean, this has been one of the key concerns among some Republican senators, that things that Bolton could have to say could be matters where the president would be entitled to invoke executive privilege. I guess my question about that is, is this a privilege that means the White House can stop Bolton from disclosing certain information, or is it only a privilege that gives Bolton a right not to disclose certain information in a context where he would be otherwise compelled to testify? I mean, can the White House assert executive privilege objections to what's in the book and either prevent its publication or prevent him from sharing information in other venues?
Well, that's a great question. And it's far more often that executive privilege is invoked to save someone who doesn't want to testify from testifying, or it's used to order someone who's currently an employee not to testify or reveal information. It's relatively rare for the government to try to use it to stop someone who wants to talk, and it's not at all clear that it would work. Just to make it even more complicated, it's not at all clear how it would work in the context of a Senate impeachment trial. Again, the Senate has the sole power to try this. They make the rules in there. Does executive privilege apply in a Senate impeachment trial? Your guess is as good as mine. It's what they decide whether it does or not. So it's not a impediment, I think, if the Senate wants to do it, but it seems fairly clear they don't want to do it.
Finally, before we go to break, I want to talk about the fact that there was a significant amount of time devoted in presentations actually on both sides to the activities of the Bidens, even though the Bidens are not on trial here. What have you made of the presentations about that? I mean, first with preemptively the House managers offering a defense of Joe Biden's activities with regard to Ukraine. Then you have Pam Bondi, the former attorney general of Florida, there basically to be the Biden expert on behalf of Donald Trump and make a case that you know, the Bidens were really up to no good in Ukraine. Has any of that conversation been productive, useful, relevant, et cetera?
Well, I mean, the theory on exactly how the Bidens were crooked has never been clear, and I don't think the impeachment trial made it a lot clear. It certainly does seem skeevy that you know, the son of a vice president gets hired as a director without necessarily having any relevant skills. But I'm not sure if it's skeevy in a way that shows illegal misconduct as opposed to just general ugly nepotism of the sort we see a lot in America. And they really haven't articulated on the Republican side how exactly it would be illegal as opposed to unseemly. Moreover, I think that the House managers and the Democratic senators have been doing a fairly effective job of pointing out the inconsistencies in this theory. During the question time today, the GOP was getting some tough questions about what did Trump ever do to show that he cared in the least about this corruption issue before it became clear that Joe Biden was going to run for president. And there were no good answers for that. So, I think it's an issue that partisans on both sides are just going to go their partisan way. People who like Trump are going to be convinced that Biden's a crook, and people who don't are going to see it as there's no there at all.
I mean, the president's claim that his concern here was about corruption, I mean, it goes to a theme that we've seen show up in a few places about crimes that require certain kinds of specific intent, right? Where, you know, if you have to demonstrate something about the state of mind of the person who committed an act, that can be very challenging. And there's, you know, there's sort of a lot of leeway for their own account of why they did what they did. In this instance, I mean, the president is literally on the record advocating for the repeal of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which prohibits U.S. businesses from paying bribes abroad, because the president says that puts U.S. businesses at an unfair disadvantage. So, I mean, you know, substantively, the president is pro-corruption. The president has a record not only of not being concerned about corruption in foreign countries, but actually advocating a policy that would increase the amount of corruption in foreign countries. I guess the question is, and I realize the Senate gets to make up its own standards here, to what extent do you have to defer to the president's claim that the reason that he acted in this way was that he cared about corruption in Ukraine? Because it's, you know, that's obviously bullshit. But I'm not inside the president's head. I can't prove his reasons for taking any set of actions that he did.
Well, the Senate's a trier of fact, and I agree with you that it's bullshit. I don't think you have to defer to it or respect it at all. In addition to the indications that you correctly identified where Trump has actually advocated foreign corruption, if he were interested in corruption, or if the GOP genuinely were, this would not be the way you would investigate it. I mean, the GOP held the House and the Senate, and they didn't do anything to investigate this issue. And if Trump wanted to make something happen, generally the way it would happen would be an investigation here and request through channels, through things like the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty and things like that, to get admissible evidence that could be used in a proceeding here. Just casually asking a foreign country to investigate itself, an investigation you don't control and that is not going to yield anything that you can use here, does not, to me, even remotely plausibly suggest a genuine interest in corruption.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we can talk about Rudy Giuliani. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. So I really think we should talk about Rudy Giuliani. The president's attorneys devoted a surprising amount of time to explaining and defending his actions, even though he, like Hunter Biden and Joe Biden, is not on trial here. So how did that go?
Actually, it didn't go as terribly as you would think. I think Rudy Giuliani has successfully set such an incredibly low bar for himself in terms of tripping over his words and saying disastrous things that if he just says something that's kind of stupid, it seems like it's the greatest oration ever. So he has been not in the news as much as the focus has been on what's going on actually in the Senate in the impeachment trial. But he has launched a podcast, and it's both a podcast and a YouTube video. It's very slickly produced. There's a whole lot of graphics that seem to imply that this is a search for truth and common sense. There are invocations of Thomas Paine and the founders. And then there's Rudy talking. And again, I have to say, in fairness, I went in expecting this to be a complete train wreck. But Giuliani's discussion is calm to the extent that it's clear he has either been extremely carefully prepared or very heavily medicated. And he does not say all the crazy things you expect him to. He just make his arguments. Now, the arguments are ultimately like Dershowitz's argument, that this is on its face not a crime, and therefore the Senate should simply acquit without any evidence. He compares it to the types of cases he did as a prosecutor, where if the face of the indictment doesn't describe a crime, it can be dismissed. And he lays it out there. So I guess it's just, you know, A for effort, and not the sort of train wreck we would normally expect from him discussing the facts of the case.
Oh, and so in the Senate trial itself, Jane Raskin, who had previously been co-counsel with him defending the president during the Mueller investigation, she went up there and basically tried to square this circle of what was Giuliani doing in Ukraine? Was he there in a personal capacity doing personal errands for the president, or was he there as an informal but United States representative conducting diplomacy on behalf of the country? And what she was saying basically is he was the president's attorney, but he wasn't there on a political errand. He was there to clear the president's name related to things that happened with Ukraine in the 2016 election, some of which are invented in the president's head, the idea that, you know, the CrowdStrike server is in Ukraine or something like that. But there were public statements by Ukrainian officials that were critical of him in 2016. He's upset about the way that he feels Ukraine acted in the 2016 election and that Giuliani was there to clear that up. And so that's why he was there as the president's personal attorney, but this wasn't improper. It was a proper action on his behalf. Now, the issue with that for me is it doesn't address the Bidens at all. Even if the president had a set of valid grievances with regard to 2016, and again, a lot of the grievances are made up, how does that explain Giuliani's actions with regard to the Bidens? Either that has to have been an effort to seek a bona fide investigation with relation to corruption, and as we discussed earlier in the show, there are reasons to think that this does not at all look like that, or it was an effort to seek a hit job against one of his political opponents. It clearly was a political errand what he was doing with regard to 2020.
Absolutely. Or the third possibility, at least with respect to his efforts in connection with getting rid of Ambassador Yovanovitch, it could have been an effort to benefit some of his other clients other than the president. I thought that one of the effective things that the president's lawyers did was to argue and suggest that, you know, the issue here is what the president did, not what Rudy Giuliani did. They kind of did a classic trial tactic where they used him as the empty chair and suggested, look, whatever this nut was doing, that's not on the president, that's on him. Focus on the president. That was not a bad argument because, indeed, it's clear that Rudy's antics look bad, and if you can kind of separate them from the president, that makes things much better for the president.
Well, but I mean, that assumes that his antics were separate from the president, that he wasn't doing this with the president's approval or at the president's instruction, and conceivably that's a reason that you would have wanted testimony from Rudy Giuliani, and that was something that the president's lawyers also pointed out, that if the claim is that, you know, Rudy Giuliani's bad acts were the president's bad acts, why hasn't he been subpoenaed to testify? Now, when the House tried to get other kinds of cooperation from Giuliani, he was extremely uncooperative. So I think it's not that House Democrats did not want to hear from Giuliani at all. But I mean, I guess, you know, if this was a criminal trial of the president, certainly you'd want Giuliani's testimony. He'd be a very relevant witness, right?
Absolutely. Assuming he wasn't asserting attorney-client privilege or other privileges that you couldn't overcome.
Or taking the Fifth.
Taking the Fifth. Yes, exactly. So I think you would, but I think not calling him was part of the Democrats' general strategy of not getting bogged down into lengthy court battles and instead moving swiftly to an impeachment vote.
Everyone is interested in this trial. That includes thumb-headed henchman Lev Parnas, who showed up to the Capitol building on Wednesday but couldn't get into the trial because his ankle monitor violates the Senate's ban on electronic devices in the chamber. That seems like a new one.
Yeah, haven't run into that before. And his lawyer was actually going to ask the federal judge overseeing his prosecution whether he could get spared from wearing the ankle bracelet for a day, which I think would make the greatest caper movie ever, where you have a plot to get Lev Parnas out of the country by getting him into the Senate without an ankle bracelet, then smuggling him out. I would watch that like crazy. But no, it is unusual. There was a huge procession of him walking to the Senate, very much a circus and very much part of sort of the slightly surreal circus-like atmosphere of this whole thing.
And this is also in a week where we got this tape of a fundraising dinner for a Trump-related entity back in 2018, where the president has a long, wide-ranging conversation with a number of people, including Lev Parnas. This is where Lev Parnas tells the president that Marie Yovanovitch, who is then serving as the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine in Kyiv, is going around bad-mouthing him. And he gets the president all riled up and shouting, you know, take her out, remove her. And so I think this is interesting in a few ways, one of which is that it suggests that Parnas's desire to remove the ambassador well predates any concerns that the president had about what she might be doing with regard to investigations of the Bidens that he wanted or anything else. That Parnas had business interests in Ukraine that he thought the ambassador was standing in the way of, and he had reasons to try to get the president to decide that the ambassador was an enemy of Donald Trump's, not just of Lev Parnas's.
Well, exactly. And that's connected to the question of whether Rudy Giuliani's impulses were only about going after Biden, or were they also about helping out Ukrainian or Russian clients. But to me, less shocking than Trump using vivid speech of the sort he uses all the time. And I don't agree with people who said that it seemed to be a physical threat. It just seemed to be typical Trumpian bluster. More shocking to that is the terrible level of operational security, where the President of the United States is having these policy discussions and some total idiot like this guy can walk in and record it on an iPhone. Not to mention the fact the president's choice of dinner companions when talking about things like this, and, you know, going off on these subjects with someone like Lev Parnas, who should not be the chief executive's choice of someone to trade foreign policy quips about. Although I suppose if you realize that his alternative is Jared Kushner, it doesn't seem so bad anymore.
Well, but so that, I mean, this points toward a sort of funny possibility that is not a good political defense for the president, and he's never going to say it out loud. But, you know, the reasons that the president took his interventions in Ukraine, his improper actions here, and the question of, you know, was it for his personal benefit? Was it for the national interest? There's this additional option that he was basically duped into interfering in Ukraine in certain ways for somebody else's personal interest, which doesn't reflect well on the president, but conceivably could be some sort of defense of his actions, that, you know, if it was, you know, fundamentally for Lev Parnas's energy business efforts, in which the president does not have an apparent financial stake, then maybe that's a less corrupt purpose.
Right. This is a defense that your guy was duped, that you would try very hard to get your client to accept to let you make a trial. And then ultimately the client would likely refuse, and then you'd still sneak it in anyway in the closing argument and have them yell at you in the hallway afterwards. But I think it's perfectly plausible. I mean, there's nothing new in this, Josh, that we haven't seen before. And, you know, the famous line from Watergate was that, you know, these aren't the smartest guys in the world, and things got out of hand. It could be very much like that here, that the president is very easily emotionally manipulated and provoked into outbursts and actions, and he was played by a con man.
But this is also a key area of legal risk for Lev Parnas and maybe for some people around him, right? Because, you know, if Lev Parnas was doing this for his own financial interests, I mean, at least in terms of the Foreign Agents Registration Act, that's not a problem because Lev Parnas is a U.S. citizen. But if it was for foreign business partners that he had, and, you know, this again goes to the question of, you know, was Lev Parnas an unregistered foreign agent? And I, you know, conceivably Giuliani has some risk related to this as well, since he was, you know, these were business associates of his. Whatever they were leaning on the president to do, if it wasn't for the president's either policy interest or political interest, if it was for somebody else's business interest, that could be a Foreign Agents Registration Act issue.
Absolutely. Parnas faces sort of danger whichever direction he looks on this. He's already got the pending indictment. There's every indication that the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York is looking for theories on which to do a superseding indictment. And so, you know, that's why I think still that he's hoping that he would be called to some sort of hearing in Congress and might get some sort of immunity.
Speaking of multiple fronts of legal risk, let's talk about Michael Avenatti. Michael Avenatti's criminal trial related to his alleged attempt to extort Nike has begun in New York City. And the first challenge of starting this trial has been jury selection, how to find jurors who can judge Avenatti impartially. The New York Post has been doing some fun reporting on this. One potential juror called Avenatti a notorious scumbag on a juror questionnaire. He was not impaneled. Another said that he was too biased against Nike to sit on this jury. He didn't like the way that Nike treats athletes. There was another juror who said he was too sad over the death of Nike endorser Kobe Bryant to sit in a trial that involved Nike. And then there was one woman who showed up dressed head to toe in Nike swag who was also dismissed. So it seems like the excuses for getting out of jury duty are maybe more fun than usual with this trial.
Josh, any trial lawyer has seen jurors make efforts to not get put on a jury, particularly for a longer case. And this was a fairly typical array of them, you know, really voicing strong opposition to one side or the other, or the decked out Nike swag was particularly good. I do think that the lawyers for Avenatti have to be a little worried about how not uncommon the sort of vitriol towards him was in some of the jury questionnaires and answers. So even if you pick a jury that doesn't say that outright openly, you worry that it's still in there and the other people were just too discreet to spout it out.
This reminds me of the jury selection for the Martin Shkreli trial a year or two ago, where you had this parade of potential jurors saying not implausibly that they think that Martin Shkreli is the worst person on earth and they can't judge him impartially. And then finally, after going through dozens and dozens of potential jurors, the judge got to someone who said he'd never even heard of Martin Shkreli. And she was super pleased, and I believe that person ended up on the jury. Do we know how Avenatti has dealt with the issues that we were discussing last week, that the accusations against him in California that led to the revocation of his bail and led to the U.S. Marshals having to fly him to New York where he's being held in custody? That had to do with the way he was handling his money, allegations that he was shielding money from creditors by moving it around in shady ways. And there was a concern about what that meant for money that he was spending on his legal defense. Did he actually have the legal right to pay money to his lawyers, to expert witnesses, et cetera? How has that been worked out as he goes to trial?
We don't really know for sure. So there may have been some discussions behind the scenes. His lawyers may have made some difficult choices about taking the risk that they're not going to get paid or that they would have to front money. But the ultimate exact resolution of it has not been public. His lawyers clearly were willing to go forward. They probably perceived correctly the judge might not let them out even if they're not being paid. But it's entirely possible that the sort of behind the scenes assurances that were talked about by the judge were somehow made, because they've all transitioned on to resolving other issues about what's going to happen in the trial and where the real action is going to be.
Yes, that's a remarkable thing. If your client runs out of money or something happens to his money, they can make you try the case anyway?
They can. The closer you are to the trial, the bigger a danger it is for a lawyer. It's generally a bigger danger for a criminal case than a civil, and that's why lawyers tend to be careful to get their money up front, to make sure that Mr. Green shows up, as we would say.
There's a lot we can talk about, but I think that's a good place for us to leave it this week. Ken White, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us a voicemail at 424-538-8888. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.